Let's call this one the Ghost of Economy Future, shall we? We'll talk manufacturing as well, and then goats. We've got goats from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the second day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We know what this economy is like right now, right? Shaky in many parts, uneven in who's recovering and who's not, uncertain for both people and businesses. So the forecast we got yesterday from the Congressional Budget Office, its guesses for this year were promising. Even without more federal relief, we're on track for the economy to be roughly back where it was in the before times by the middle of this year. Thank you, vaccines. The labor market is going to take longer, but let's examine that baseline concept for a second here. The idea of getting back to the pre-pandemic economy. Because as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, even if the numbers do get back to where they used to be, the economy's probably going to look real different.
Even though gross domestic product can kind of be a shorthand for how an economy is doing,
GDP growth does not translate into equal growth of earnings and employment.
Ariane Hegovich is with the Institute for Women's Policy Research. She says the before times were kind of a perfect example of this. Unemployment was low, but often significantly higher for some groups, like Black and Latinx workers. Also,
a lot of women worked in jobs where you, even with full-time year-round working, you could not feed yourself. You still needed to have SNAP benefits, particularly if you had kids.
Then came the pandemic, where the economic fallout was far worse for women and people of color, particularly in the service sector. Emily Nix teaches labor economics at the USC Marshall School of Business and says all this will shape what the recovery looks like.
If you come from a wealthier background, you bounce back a lot faster than if you come from a poor background. And so another concern we might have is that this pandemic is going to increase income inequality.
The same logic applies for small businesses.
I think we need to define what is normal.
Cherise Conanan Johnson is a managing partner at the advisory firm Next Street.
How are we going to make sure that the communities and small businesses that have been systemically left back pre-pandemic are getting the systemic changes I think that we need to make sure that they're successful?
She says for those communities, returning to pre-pandemic economic conditions might not be enough for an actual economic recovery. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
A brief personnel note before we go on. Jeff Bezos has kicked himself upstairs. Amazon announced this afternoon that its founder is going to step down as CEO this summer to become executive chairman, so not totally giving up power. Andy Jassy is going to be the new guy. He's been running AWS, Amazon Web Services, its omnipresent cloud computing division. Amazon shares did hiccup a little bit after hours. Still, though, something like $3,300 apiece. Update across the board for the major indices. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Senate Republicans and the White House continue their politicking about another round of help for this economy. That, the politics, is covered extensively elsewhere on your public radio dial. We are going to talk about the relief money actually reaching people and businesses. The Small Business Administration gave us an update this week on how the latest round of the Paycheck Protection Program is going so far. Marketplace's Justin Ho has been on that story for us.
In the weeks leading up to this latest round of PPP loans, Dan Eaton at LaSalle State Bank in Illinois says he and his colleagues sent emails and letters to business customers telling them to get ready. But
I would say the response has been a little slower than we anticipated.
Eaton says there could be a few reasons for that. For one, there are more restrictions on this round. Businesses have to show that revenue dropped 25% or more. And despite the bank's best efforts,
I think we sometimes fear that customers or just any business in our community might overlook a program like the Second Draw PPP.
The fact that 3/4 of the available money is untouched is a sign that future aid packages should include different forms of relief, says DDA Trent with the advocacy group Main Street Alliance.
Something that we've been advocating from the get-go was a more flexible grants program.
Grants would be less likely to restrict how business owners spend the money. Naomi Pomeroy runs a mealbox company called Ripe Cooperative in Portland, Oregon. She says it's hard for business owners to meet PPP spending requirements.
It's fuzzy math when you think about telling somebody that they have to have 60% of their money spent on payroll when they can only have 25% occupancy. And
one proposal in Congress would establish a dedicated grant program for restaurants. Pomeroy says that would make a huge difference.
We have enough debt on our plates. We have enough restrictions and hoops to jump through. And at this point, our sheer survival depends on getting some funding as grants.
Especially, she says, now that restaurant owners are struggling to get through the colder months. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
What's that? Do I have a recommendation for an early morning business and economics program? Why, yes. Yes, I do. The Marketplace Morning Report, David Brancaccio. And the gang, everything you need to know to start your economic day. China manufactures more stuff than any other country in the world, about 28% of total global factory output. The United States in the second slot, less than half of China's production. And over the past decade, while Chinese manufacturing has grown as a percentage of its gross domestic product, manufacturing here has decreased slightly by that same measure. That's been a tad anxiety-provoking in this country and, to some degree, was part of the Trump administration's trade war that President Biden is now going to have to deal with, by the way. So we asked Marketplace's Jennifer Pack and Sabri Benishour what that relationship might look like on the ground.
So there's this app called Wish. It's basically a direct line between shoppers in the U.S.
and manufacturers in China. Americans order a lot from Chinese vendors.
Take Elizabeth Taylor, who runs a cleaning business in Alta, Iowa. She's used Wish to order a projector, a solar panel.
I got little space earrings. They're like little two little space men.
The main reason she keeps coming back?
Affordability. I mean, they've got pretty good prices.
Those spaceman earrings she bought, they cost her just $8, including shipping, all the way from here in China.
Which is super cheap, but how is it that cheap?
Labor, for one. We visited the Wish vendor Taylor bought her earrings from in Shanghai, called Vassi. Warehouse manager Zhou Huilian and other staff are wearing their winter coats. There's no indoor heating. Still, she says the job is pretty good.
There's no overtime required. When I used to work in factories in southern China, I worked 12 to 14 hours a day.
14-hour days?
Yeah, Mondays to Saturdays. A six-day work week is pretty common in most industries in China.
No unions.
None that are effective. And also, Zhou Huilian doesn't always mind overtime. It means a chance to earn more, which is the only reason she left the fields of central Hunan for Shanghai. She earns over $4 an hour, overseeing items packed and sent to the U.S., like the spaceman earrings for Elizabeth Taylor.
By comparison, Taylor makes $25 an hour.
That's a huge difference in wages, and a big reason why so many manufacturing jobs were shifted from the U.S. to China. 2.7 million by some count.
And the wage level isn't just about differences in labor standards or working conditions. It's actually also a product of the wealth gap between the U.S. and China. David Auder is an economist at MIT. He says Chinese labor is cheaper for the same reason labor in any developing country is going to be cheaper.
Where people are poorer, their time has a lower price in dollars. They're willing to work for less money because their outside options are much weaker. And that's the way countries develop.
Including the U.S., historically, by the way. There's something else about China's labor supply that's allowed it to keep fueling its manufacturing base, and that is just sheer numbers.
Hundreds of millions of people who, starting in the 1980s, quit their rural villages, leaving behind young children, spouses, and elderly parents. They've gone to work in factories hundreds of miles away. Again, economist David Otter.
You had this kind of, for multiple decades, nearly inexhaustible supply of cheap labor.
American manufacturing hasn't disappeared. It's just gone high-end and high-tech. Yi Wen is an economist with the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and author of The Making of an Economic Superpower, Unlocking China's Secret of Rapid Industrialization.
But the U.S. still has a big manufacturing sector. However, they only produce high-tech, such as airplanes, computer chips, right?
Another reason China is so strong in manufacturing is because producers organize themselves into industrial clusters.
Clusters as in all parts of a supply chain close to one another, wrapped up into little nuggets of efficiency.
Exactly. There are entire Chinese towns manufacturing only zippers, trash bins, or lingerie. Zhou Xiaohuan's firm manufactures charging cables that are sold on Wish and Amazon.
The reason Chinese products are cheap for American customers is because of China's concentrated supply chain and high efficiency. From start to finish, a factory can mass produce a product within 2 weeks.
He says Chinese manufacturers aren't artificially suppressing their prices.
Which is something many outside of China have at times disputed.
Chinese companies have been accused of receiving unfair subsidies and engaging in dumping for decades.
Scott Kennedy is senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
The China export machine is both comparative advantage and an amazing amount of skilled labor and these manufacturing clusters, but it's also these unfair trade practices, the state support, the protected home market, and the dumping abroad.
And as China becomes wealthier, there's a fear that the same model that allows it to produce so much at such cheap prices is being applied to high-end manufacturing and high-tech industries.
David Otter again.
I'm not especially worried that, you know, my tennis sneakers are made in China. I am concerned about the future of the aircraft industry, of the telecommunications sector, of the automotive sector, power generation sector. These things I'm really worried about.
The high-tech sectors where the U.S. leads.
And sectors where China may soon rival the U.S. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak.
And in New York, I'm Sabri Benishore.
For Marketplace.
Coming up.
I think I want to work for like people who make robots and stuff like that.
I don't know. Maybe. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 475 today, 1.5%, 30,687. The NASDAQ rose 209 points, also 1.5%, finished at 13,612. The S&P 500 jumped 52 points, just shy of 1.4%. 3,826. Hormel Foods is reportedly in talks to buy the Planters snack business from Kraft Heinz for about $3 billion. Shares in Hormel picked up about 4% on the day. Shares in Kraft down about 0.2%. It's not peanuts, you know. Get it? Peanuts? Planters? After yesterday's gains, a whole bunch of silver mining companies came back down today. Comstock Mining, which we talked about yesterday, fell 35.5% today. GameStop, ticker symbol GME, down $135 off 60%, 60% on the day. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Warner Music reported quarterly profits this week. They did fine, made some money. But as Marketplace's Jasmine Garz reports, the interesting thing is the changes that are happening in how money is made in music right now.
Warner Music Group reported that streaming revenue was up 17.5% in the last quarter. Streaming services like Spotify and iTunes are still major, but the jump was also due to the social media platform TikTok, which features short videos, often with music. Professor George Howard teaches business at Berklee College of Music. He says this, in part, reflects how the pandemic has changed the way we listen.
People aren't commuting as much, so they're not listening to music in the car. People aren't drowning out their coworkers in cubicles with music.
What a lot of people are doing is spending time on social media. Warner Brothers recently signed a licensing deal with TikTok. The app has become a way for old hits to be revived and new hits to make it big. That's Lil Nas X, one of the most notable artists to be launched on TikTok. Yesterday's earnings report also highlighted how, during the pandemic, gaming platforms have been hosting live performances. Peter Volley is a music analyst at eMarketer.
There were really no live concerts in 2020. There likely won't be a lot of live music this year either. So a lot of that is shifting online.
Just last month, Warner invested a reported eight figures in Roblox, a gaming platform geared towards kids with 150 million monthly users. So while the music industry is notoriously slow to change, it's clear the pandemic is already causing massive shifts. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
It's been a rough couple of weather days in some parts of the country. Snow, high winds, some power outages, and transportation problems. No winter storms out here in California, but Mother Nature is still throwing a wrench into the works of some businesses. Here is today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Gloria Putnam. I'm in Vallejo, California, in the Angeles National Forest. I manage the North American business for a Chinese semiconductor company, and I also run a goat ranch. Angela's Crest Creamery is a small goat ranch where we are working on demonstrating a type of agriculture that doesn't need imported water. We're not a profitable food business, so our income traditionally comes from our Airbnb business for farm stays and also educational events that we host. Our business was already closed starting in March because of the pandemic. And then the Bobcat fire came through here on September 19th. We evacuated all of the goats and two pigs and a horse and six dogs. We set up kind of an evacuation camp at a ranch just 6 miles north of here, from which we could actually look back up at the mountain and watch the fire hitting the ranch. We already had the financial hit of not having our income from the business since March, and then now with the fire, we've also lost our free food source. So now we have to buy hay, alfalfa hay, that we bring in, and it costs about $4,000 a month to keep the goats fed. It's a ridiculous amount of money. For a ranch with no income, it's a lot of money. And it's also kind of the opposite of what we're trying to demonstrate in terms of sustainability, because the hay is grown in the desert by pumping groundwater, so it's basically imported water. During the fire, we set up a hay fund on our website because people were asking how they can help us. And it was so helpful, actually, because during the week of the fire and the couple weeks after, we got a lot of contributions. And that allowed us to not have to worry about how to feed the goats while we were also trying to figure out just how to survive. The fire has been a pretty traumatic event for us, and we're very strong people and very resilient, which you have to be to live in the mountains with animals. But it's definitely challenged us in a way that we didn't anticipate. You know, both financially, but also just emotionally, and we feel kind of exhausted and tired, and we have to, at this moment, try and solve all these really complicated problems. So, you know, one of the reasons that the Hay Fund has been so important is that it gives us a little bit of time to recover ourselves while we think through these complicated problems and make the right decisions.
Gloria Putnam runs Angela's Crest Creamery in the mountains just north of Los Angeles. She's got a newsletter, too, about that ranch's recovery from the Bobcat fire. And while you're online checking that out, let us know what's happening with you, would you? You can do that at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Higher education in this economy is not without its challenges. There's the pandemic, of course, most immediately. There's unequal access, how straight up expensive it can be, and now decreasing demand. A study from McKinsey says the number of high school graduates in the United States is expected to peak in the next several years, and so there's a move to expand the kinds of education being offered and to whom. From GBH in Boston, Kirk Carapeza reports.
Just as COVID-19 hit the region in March, Claudia Cabrera was accepted into a new certificate program at Stonehill College, a four-year liberal arts school south of Boston.
I had my GED for about a year, and I didn't really know where I wanted to go with my career, my education. I felt like I wasn't going to be able to go back to school because I was a young mom.
The 24-year-old mother of twins was also homeless. Living in a shelter with 20 other families, she was exposed to someone with COVID-19. She says although she didn't get sick,
I just needed to get out of there.
Stuck in the shelter, Cabrera saw Stonehill's certificate program as an opportunity to earn a living wage as a technician.
I'm a hands-on type of learner. I don't really understand until I do it for myself.
Between 2019 and 2037, the number of new high school graduates in New England is expected to shrink by nearly 13%. And that spells problems for small colleges like Stonehill and for the region's high-skills economy. Massachusetts alone is facing a major shortage of technicians. A handful of liberal arts schools have invested in career and technical certificate programs that cost students less and last just a few semesters.
These institutions are needing to enroll as many learners as they possibly can.
Shailen Jotishi is a senior policy analyst at the think tank New America. He recommends all kinds of colleges adopt short-term, non-degree programs as the traditional college-going demographic shrinks.
In order to stay afloat and hopefully expand, private liberal arts colleges will need to come up with new sorts of offerings that respond to the market demands.
Jotishi points to research that finds since March, Americans are increasingly interested in non-degree certificate opportunities.
Offering more short-term affordable programs will make you more attractive to a broader range of learners, whether they're traditional college age or adult learners.
Stonehill now offers certificates that cost about $10,000 compared to the full cost of attendance that can run north of $65,000 a year.
I think it provides access to a different type of student that Stonehill has not catered to.
That's Melissa Ratliff, the new dean of graduate admissions at Stonehill. She says the college traditionally serves recent high school grads who live in dorms. So she says administrators were surprised by some of the older students' needs.
We had some students that didn't have access to Wi-Fi. They didn't have access to a reliable laptop.
Stonehill secured funding from professional societies to loan students laptops and offset tuition. The college also helped Claudia Cabrera find an apartment that she could afford so she could leave the shelter.
Can you please pick that up off the floor? You guys want to start cleaning and making lunch?
Inside her new apartment, Cabrera negotiates with her twins.
Mommy, I got spirit.
After falling behind last semester, she says she's all caught up on her coursework now.
I think I want to work for like people who make robots and stuff like that.
With technology being such a big thing in the world right now, especially during COVID.
Cabrera expects to complete her advanced manufacturing courses later this year before entering the workforce. In Boston, I'm Kirk Carapeza for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, we started with an item about a company that has as one of its missions to sell everything. We end with a company that has as its mission, it seems, to deliver everything. Uber announced today it's going to spend $1 billion, $1.1 billion to be precise, to buy Drizly, the alcohol delivery service, 1Z, by the way. It is, according to the Wine and Spirits Wholesalers of America, the biggest deal yet in the online alcohol business, or in a word, reading between the lines here, if I might, pandemic. All right, we're out of here, but not without your Tuesday moment of economic context. One more quick thought on Amazon. You know, it's not an accident that Andy Jassy is moving from running AWS, the company's cloud business, to being in charge of the whole smash. You can make a case that that whole retail dominance thing is kind of just a side hustle, right? Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Ben Hethcote, and Janet Wintz. Tarn Yeves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.